Foundation Radio is now an exclusive brand partner with WWEshop.com. Pick up all your favorite new merchandise from Roman Reigns.
Acknowledge me.
Cody Rhodes.
I have to finish the story.
LA Knight.
Let me talk to you.
And more using our exclusive link in the show notes. Click below and show your support today for your favorite WWE superstar at WWEshop.com.
Yeah!
Foundation Radio is brought to you by 10th Ward Barbershop, a full-service barbershop offering high-quality haircuts, beard trims, and hot shaves. 10th Ward Barbershop proudly serves the historic Lawrenceville 10th Ward and surrounding Pittsburgh areas. Adam frequents 10th Ward Barbershop when he swings through the area and loves Ryan Kane's laser-sharp precision on both his hair and beard needs. But you don't have to take his word for it. WWE superstars Finn Balor and Corey Graves frequent 10th Ward Barbershop for their hair and beard needs. The team at 10th Ward accepts walk-ins, but schedules fill up quickly, so the best way to see them is to make an appointment at 10thwardbarbershop.com. That's 10thwardbarbershop.com. Make sure to grab some Silk Panther hair products in-shop or online while you're there. Schedule your appointment today to see Kane, Jordan, and the rest of the team at 10th Ward Barbershop today, and we thank them for sponsoring the program.
You're listening to the Premier Podcast Network.
World and welcome to Foundation Radio. My name is Adam Bernard. Thank you so much for joining me again today. My guest is the actor best known for his roles as Warden Leo Glynn in the fabled HBO program Oz, as well as his roles in The Crow, The Basketball Diaries, and currently starring as Winston Zeddemore in Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, Ernie Hudson. Thank you so much for your time, sir. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you, sir. And so I wanted to talk to you about Frozen Empire to start here. So Winston has now become this almost Tony Stark-like character in the movie franchise. Tell me more about the evolution of Winston as a character and how it's felt for you to see him take on this more prominent role inside the universe.
Well, I think a lot of fans are aware that the very first film was a challenge. It was wonderful working on, but I always felt the studio kind of limited the character. I think that's, like I said, that's pretty well known. But as we've sort of evolved over the past 30 or so years, and just talking to the, you know, Jason Reitman, Ivan's son, and Ivan actually before he transitioned, I felt the character should evolve. He's grown, just like I personally have grown. He shouldn't be in the same place. We shouldn't see Winston still looking for a job and a steady paycheck. And so the studio heard that, and thankfully that Sony was agreed with it. And it was important for me too, because Winston was sort of the everyman character for a lot of kids. And I wanted him to be sort of an example of what's possible. And so that's really kind of how it, and Jason and Gil, who wrote this last script, they were on board with that. And I'm so happy to be able to play a lot more than, you know, just the guy who's on the team.
Now, it's been clear amongst a bunch of us in the fandom as well, because I'm a longtime Ghostbusters fan from the time I was little. It's been clear that you've been one of the most vocal supporters about continuing the franchise and also your love of this character. What about the Ghostbusters fandom keeps you coming back to it?
You know, it's the fans. I mean, honestly, when we did the first movie, it was huge. And it just went on and on and on. But eventually all films, you know, people lose interest, other things come out. And that was a year, 84 was the 80s were a great time for movies. And so I expected this movie, like so many others, to just, you know, get pushed to the side. But what amazed me was after 5-10 years, fans were not only still loving the movie, but, you know, building their costumes and their cars and their backpacks. And it really kind of blew my mind that, And 15, 20 years, the fans, I just got back from Pittsburgh to that, from the Steel City Con. It's amazing to me. And I feel so humbled and touched by it. I just felt the studio, Sony, I'm wanting to be critical. It took them a little while to kind of get just how important this film was to people. And especially to families, you know, families with little kids. It was the kind of movie that you could actually share with your grandkids and not be embarrassed by. Right. I remember going to with one of my grandkids to see Fatal Attraction without understanding what the movie was.
Oh, no.
And I just sat there going, oh, my God. No. So, you know, so and Ghostbusters is one of those movies that you can definitely share.
Yeah, I would imagine that was probably an awkward conversation after the movie was done. But I'm glad that I'm glad that this movie is more along those lines. I also want to talk about William Atherton reprised his role in this movie as the principal antagonist and one of my least favorite characters of all time, Walter Peck. Tell me how much you enjoyed working with William again and what it's like to really incorporate so much history, because we're also on the 40th anniversary of the original Ghostbusters. Tell me what it was like to work with William and how cool it was to reincorporate some of that history into this new story.
Well, you know, in Afterlife, it was, for me, it was almost spiritual to finally see Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd in their Ghostbuster jumpsuit. And when we first met, I thought, wow, this is, I couldn't believe it was actually happening. But in this one, seeing Bill Atherton, who I just, he's been a friend for a long time, I have so much respect for his work. To me, it was always he was always one of those underrated actors who never really got that moment that he that I really think he's you know, he deserved it. He's so talented. And that's this business. You know, you never know which way it's going to go. But what I loved about him and when we got to the scenes that we were doing, it was the way he shows up. When you get to be a certain age, a lot of people, they just have they struggle with issues. But when I see someone from, you know, been doing this for as long as I have, and they show up on point and, you know, and just nail the scenes, I was, it makes me very, very proud. So I can't say enough great things about Bill. And he was always, because the character, you know, the man with no dick, you know what I mean? It was like a fans. So I was happy, first off, that he came, was willing to come back and do this. And, not just him, but a lot of the people who, you know, when you've been doing this 30, 40, 50 years, I just have a lot of respect for your resilience.
Yeah, that is the man with no dick has become a permanent part of my lexicon as I've gotten older. So it's one of my favorite insults. So I want to thank you all for that as well, incorporating that into my world. But just from an actor standpoint, people talk about how heavy the proton packs were from the original movies. How has the prop technology advanced since 1984 regarding those packs? And were they really as heavy as everybody said they were?
Okay, the technology has advanced everywhere. But apparently the studio, you know what I mean? I see packs. I've seen packs so cool. I saw one this weekend, you know, now he did it light up and make sounds. And, you know, when the wand came out, but it shot out a laser beam and steam sort of in the laser. I mean, incredible, really creative. But the ones that they made at the studio, they went back to the original drawing board. There were 50 pounds. Oh, and I'm like, really? Because, you know, we can do this a lot easier than carrying this around. And I'm at an age in life when I'm like, give me the pack. I'll take it. I can do it. You know, I don't want, you know, I'm ready to go. But I know some of my fellow actors, like, you know, this is, you know, we need to sit down, you know. So the ones we wear in the movie, except for the little rubber ones where they, you know, you do the stunts with, but they were heavy and they're not the most comfortable. The designer, when they were putting it together, some things they failed to do, like how do you take the wand and just slip it back there?
Yeah.
How do you get it on? You need help putting this stuff on. You know? So it looks great when it's on, but trust me, you'll need somebody to help out.
Yeah, I was going to say that the visuals look great, but I'm sure it's very cumbersome. Yeah. You mentioned working with Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd again. Do you have any fun stories from the set from this time around? Anything that stood out to you about this experience being back together with them?
Yeah, you know, I just, all of it sort of comes flooding back, you know, at the time when I first met him. You know, they've always been so, so cool. Bill has been, you know, they just sort of embraced me, you know. I wasn't from their pack, you know, because they were, you know, they were a team from Saturday Night Live, from Second City. They made several movies together. They were already well established. And I was this actor coming in, and I don't come from the improv theater. Sort of done it all, but mostly my training, I'm an actor, and that's what my training is. But they were so kind. And I look back, especially on the first film, and I have a lot of lines that people still quote, and that was really thanks to them, because all those great lines, they could have taken them all and just like, okay. But they were always so careful to make sure they included me. Like I said, they were great. The studio, not so much. Right. But at the time, I'm sure at the time it was that studio. I don't want to criticize them now. But yeah, they were just great. And we shot in New York. Mm. And Bill Murray was so well loved that people would literally see him driving down the street and slam on their brakes, jump out of their cars with the car still running, run over and just hug him and just... And he just was so gracious about it. And I thought, wow, to be at that level and just the generosity he showed to his fans, if I ever get there, I want to be able to, you know, sometimes you work with actors who really demonstrate appreciation and graciousness. And I always loved watching that, how, you know, just how he and Harold Ramis was always the go-to guy. And I know in the very beginning when the scenes for me were cut and I was really struggling with it. And Harold was the one who just sort of talked me through it, you know, because when you get a role, there's a part of you just want to say to hell with this. Yeah. And the reason I didn't say to hell with this was Harold. Harold was, he would, you know, he was always accessible, always there. And Danny was just really great and inclusive. And I really, Danny is the one who would say, you know, let Winston say this. And then they would throw out a line like, we have the tools, we have the talent, you know, or, you know, what is it? If anyone asks if you're God, you say yes. And that a lot of that was Danny. Yeah. They made me feel welcome, even though, like I said, at the time it felt like an uphill struggle sometimes.
Yeah. I'm glad that they were as supportive as it was. Again, if anyone asks if you're a God, you say yes. I think that reprisal in Afterlife got the biggest pop out of me out of anything in the movie. I just loved it so much. So thank you for that. I have a specific question for you from my dear friend, Paul Brown. He wants to know, when you were filming, or how did the filming of the ghost train scene in Ghostbusters 2 work with the practical effects? And how long did they actually have you hold that scream while the train was running through you?
Well, you know, as an actor, you kind of, you know, I want to believe this make-believe world is really existing. So the first thing for me is, you know, if I don't believe it, then it's not going to work, you know. My son, who was, I was a single dad, he would always say, Dad, I'm not feeling it. So I had to, you know what I mean? You got to feel it.
Right.
So for me, I'm like, okay, Ivan, there's a train. So the train's going to run over me? So yeah, the train's running over me. He's trying to explain this thing. It's like, it's just imagine a locomotive train is coming down the track and it runs over you and it hits you. And, you know, so now I'm just trying to get there. And I'm in my mind, that's what happens if you just got hit, and then you would be, you know, first off, you're totally lost in that dragged on. Now, when I saw the movie, it wasn't a locomotive train. It was a little choo-choo train coming down. And I'm like, but it worked. And I'm glad, you know, it worked perfectly. And it's one of the scenes that people will comment on the most. And it's one of the scenes that I actually laugh at. I think I have some friends who think maybe it was a little over the top. I don't know. I had fun doing it. I loved it. So there.
I was going to say, yeah, as long as you had fun doing it, that's what's most important. So it came across.
I had fun, and I felt it was honest. I mean, yeah. I think any of us, if you're on an abandoned train track and a train, you know, that's, yeah.
Listen, if that were me in that scenario, I would probably have the same reaction. So I'm glad we're on the same page there. So going forward now, I know it's been a big success in the movie theaters. It's still out right now. If you haven't seen it, go out of your way to go check it out. Where do you see the franchise going? Do you see it becoming like a gradual handing over the reins to the new team? Or do you see Winston still incorporated this in sort of this Nick Fury style overseeing character in the world?
Yeah, well, I think first off, I think this is just me, okay? Now, I'm not speaking for the studio or Jason or Gil or anybody else. If they ask me my opinion, I would love to see Ghostbusters just, you know, branch out into, I mean, I love the family to sort of carry on that part of the franchise, the Spangler family, mm-hmm. and that makes total sense. But I also see, you know, there are Ghostbusters chapters in every major city, pretty much any place I've gone in the world. I was in Pittsburgh. There are like 5 Ghostbuster chapters, and they raise a lot of money for charity. So there are ghosts in every culture. I don't care where you go in the world. We all have that same primal fear of what happens after, you know, when we're kids, what's in the closet when the lights go out. And some of it's a little scary, really scary stuff. And I'd love to see different teams of Ghostbusters. I don't see why, you know, I think this is one version, one aspect, but I think there are other, and I think Winston is international, and I think I'd love to see some of those haunted castles in Europe or, you know, Australia. I mean, we all have, like I said, these stories. So I would love to see that kind of expansion. We have the research center that we established. Also, one of the things that I really wanted, have spoken to Jason and Gil about is how do ghosts impact our lives? Not in the movie we see, it's extraordinary, it blows up stuff, but they're ghosts. We all believe that we have these ancestors who are speaking to us, who are guiding us, who are not someplace else, but right here with us. And when you have a negative spirit, and in fact, the Bible talks about possession. You know, and when Jesus, I remember the guy who the spirit came out of, and it went into the birds or the geese.
Right.
And they, you know what
I mean? It was the story of Azazel or something like that. Yeah.
I think, you know, we don't realize when we lose our temper, we feel like we've been something, so we just lose control. And I think somehow there's something going on more than we realize. You know what I mean? A loving guy who's kind and yet does something and comes to himself and he's sitting in a jail cell and wonder what just happened. And I would love to see more of the impact of what ghosts do, the ones that we can see. Now, we're Ghostbusters, so we got the equipment. We can spot them, but the average person wouldn't necessarily see the ghosts walking down the street doing stuff. But that's a whole other level. So we'll see how they, you know, I'm just a guy. I got an opinion. You know,
so. Listen, but that's a really cool idea, sort of taking it a step further and really kind of diving deep into the psychological portion of that, or even just the spiritual. I think that would be a great new storyline or a new arc to take. So I'd be very interested. Right. So Mr. Reitman, please, if you're listening, sir, which I hope you are, please, if you could listen to Mr. Hudson here, that'd be great. I'm down for it. So I want to pivot a little bit here. Just before we get back to my last question on Ghostbusters at the end of the conversation, I want to pivot just real quickly to Oz. Arguably one of the greatest television shows that's ever been created. And on the show, you had this continuing story arc with the character Clayton Hughes, who was played by Seth Gilliam. It was a multi-season arc where he becomes like a surrogate son to your character. Your experience as a single father, I know you mentioned that earlier. How much of that experience as a single father helped elevate or inspire that performance on the show?
Yeah, it was so weird because I remember Seth came on and we had that relationship. Our personal relationship was like that. I'm a dad and I'm just a real, I don't say sucker, but I'm a real, I love stories about relationships. I've always been trying to figure out, you know, I didn't have a dad when I grew up, never met my dad. And so I kind of worked out some of those issues by raising my own kids. And so when Seth came on the show and he was my, friend's son. And then in the end, he sort of turns on me. And it was really kind of freaky. I haven't seen this in a long time. But I remember he just sort of went a little nuts in the end. And I was, you know, and I know we're all acting here, but it was kind of like, it just I know it's like one of my own kids. I'm like, it kind of really threw me for a little bit of a loop. I mean, obviously, you know, we're acting, and so you play the scene, and it helped me to, but yeah, it was, I just remember that moment when suddenly he was just saying all these things and he was really into it. I'm like, what? So yeah, I think having children and family relationships has sort of, it's sort of been a part of everything I've sort of done. Just how do we connect to each other? How do we relate to each other? How do we abuse each other? How do we abuse ourselves? You know, so all that connection is really, really important. And Oz is one of those shows that I think my brother, we had an episode where my brother was arrested. So now you're the warden, but your brother, you know, and families and one person goes on and do these amazing things and somebody else does just the opposite. And now my brother's in jail. So it was, and Tom Fontana was always open to ideas about, you know, issues like that. But yeah, I remember that Seth, who I loved, and, but it was an interesting little arc on the show.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my favorites on the show, I remember like keenly watching this as a, you know, as a young man and kind of having that understanding, because it came out before The Sopranos, right? It predated The Sopranos date. Yeah. And for me, in my money, again, if anyone's asking my opinion, I think it was the show that set the tone and the tenor and sort of the forward progression of redefining television drama as a whole.
So.
What does the legacy of the show meant to you in terms of Oz really being that first template of how can we redefine television drama as this long-term storytelling as a movie almost?
Yeah, I think, in so many ways, Oz, you know, HBO sort of did a little, things a little bit different. You know, when I came on the show, wasn't quite sure what we were kind of going at. It was a little hardcore. Honestly, it was hard for me to watch at night.
Yep.
We come on at 10 o'clock at night, I'm like, I'm not watching this stuff and going to bed. And I know what's going to happen. I'm like,
sitting up staring at the ceiling every time watching it, like, oh God, what did I do?
It was really amazing. Edie Falco, you know, she came on, went on to Sopranos, and that was an amazing series. But Oz, when we hit, and yet we never got any of the awards. We never got any,
which is a crime.
Recognition.
It was a crime.
You know, I wasn't quite sure what that was about, but it was amazing. And the what I loved about it was everybody kind of, I think, realized we were doing something special, and all the actors showed up and took risks and did things that probably under different circumstances they would have second guessed, but just went into it 100%. And I love, I think it's really important in terms of television and how it's evolved and developed. And I've been blessed to be part of several projects. I mean, we talked earlier about, you know, The Crow in terms of the movie horror genre. I think it also had a big impact. So you look back over the past, you know, 50 years I've been doing this, and yeah, it's been a very interesting journey. Some of the things, some of the projects you're in the middle of, and you know, this is really, you know, this is something, we're not just doing fluff here. We're making something that might be around a while. You hope it will be.
And right, like you mentioned, The Crow too. That's one of the other things that I remember watching as a young man and thinking this is really like a pivotal moment in that genre. There's been a lot of talk recently and discourse around the reboot of The Crow that's going to be happening pretty soon. But I wanted to talk to you about the legacy of the original, you know, and kind of talking about the legacy of the original version of the movie. I wanted to know if there's any stories that you wanted to share about your time working with Brandon Lee or working on the set. What was that experience like for you?
Well, you know, I met Brandon Lee. I was doing a television series in Vancouver called Broken Badges with Miguel Ferrar. Mm. And Miguel and Brandon had been friends for a long time. They grew up together. I'm not sure about the age of it, but they had been friends for a long time. And Brandon had just finished shooting something in China, and he was flying through Vancouver. So he stopped through for about 7 or 8 days and just kind of hung out. And I got to know him fairly well. And then when The Crow came up, they sent me the script. I knew that Brandon had kind of requested me or wanted me to do this part of the officer. And so for that reason, I really wanted to do it. Also, when I saw Alex Price's reel, Alex is an amazing director, and I knew it would be something special. But Brandon, what was so special about him was he was, first of all, he was very humble, and he was very thankful to finally get this opportunity. He had done a number of movies. What we shared was we had done some films that we weren't exactly proud of or wish we had a different role or had said things that we would prefer other lines, all that stuff. And so this was his moment. This was his chance to sort of break out, to do his own, to get out from his father's shadow. He didn't want to do the martial arts stuff, you know, in the movie. He wanted to kind of, and I remember my wife, her brother passed away 2 days before the incident. Yeah. And she was kind of devastated. But the night before, Brandon took us to dinner. We'd already planned this. And so we went to dinner. We were flying out the next day to go to Minnesota for the services. And he was so generous and so kind to my wife. And I was very, very touched by that. He had a way of including everyone. Brandon wasn't the kind of guy who, when the scene is done, he'd go to his dressing room. And he didn't. He just was there for everybody. And so that night, though, he was trying to encourage me by saying, Ernie, hang in there, you know, just take me. I did this movie, was it Showdown, Little Tokyo, where he had to say something about the guy's dick being the biggest one he ever seen. He hated that, you know. And so, but now finally, you know, he's got a 3-picture deal. He's getting married right after the film. They're buying a house. And this can happen for you too, Ernie. I mean, it's just, you know, if you just don't lose the faith. And then we left town. And when I walked into my my in-law's house, there was a phone call. And it was, they're calling to say that the accident happened. And it just really kind of rattled me because, you know, we think we sort of know what's happening. You know, there's that line, was originally said it, but, you know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't see that could happen. I mean, not to this guy. You know, right. This is one of the good guys. I mean, this guy is, you know, he's done the homework. He's ready. He's fine. And I still have a hard time making sense of it. Yeah. So when you talk about doing other movies, I go, you know what? Brandon was a crow. So I just can't. I think a lot of us who are reluctant to even go back and finish the movie, we still had 8 days of shooting. And I didn't want to do it. Special effects guy said, you know, Brandon worked so hard, we have to finish this thing. So we went back and finished it, but I had gotten a film to shoot, No Escape, in Australia. I came to Australia, and so Australia was my getting approved. But we went back that 8 days, it was so dark. We're shooting at night. Brandon's double, Jeff, I'm going to get his last name wrong, but they had him dressed up in the face stuff, so he looked just like Brandon, and it was he felt awkward being around, so he was kind of lurking and something. It was just bizarre. It was like otherworldly. And when I wrapped, I got on the plane with my family, my in-laws. We all came to Australia, and it was just a real hard time. I'm not sure if I even answered the question.
No, you did. No, I apologize. No, I didn't mean to bring up anything. I know it was, I'm sure it was a very difficult time. And I know that, like I said, it was, I'm sure it was difficult to be a part of those last filming, but I, like I said, I know that the legacy of the film itself, really has withstood the test of time. And I think also too, you know, it inspired like an entire professional wrestling character and someone who is still continuing his career. Right. And like, it's the legacy of that film. So it's really cool that, you know, it feels like you're not just a part of one legacy, but you have multiple things in your career that have spawned so many wonderful things. I just think that's wonderful.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the blessings. You know, I came out to, you know, we all come out to Hollywood to get discovered. And, you know, I started working. And now with this new, we're doing press for Frozen Empire, and yep. I had a smudge on my jacket, so I put on my T-shirt, and suddenly, like, I'm finally discovered. You know, they see I have arms, you know, so, so this is kind of a fun time. But, yeah, over the years, man, I'm just so thankful to have worked with some amazing people. I remember working with Bette Davis. I did a movie called White Mama. And you know, as a kid, Bette Davis.
Yeah.
And we had the scene together, and she complimented me, and I was just so amazed. I just worked with, I remember doing Fantasy Island with Ricardo Montalban. And I was, because I was kind of new, and they had all these old stars, you know, Howard Duff, and just a bunch of people from the 30s and 40s, but they've been big stars, and, you know, and I had seen them on TV, and so it was a little awkward. I went in my dressing room, and Ricardo knocked on my door, and he says, "Welcome." And he just said, like, "Welcome to Fantasy Island. Come." And I said, "Well, you know," and he put his arm around me, and he took me around and introduced me to everybody, and sat me down at the lunch table and had them bring me. He was just so gracious. And I've been very, very blessed.
Yeah. It's wonderful to see, you know, how many projects you've been involved in. But I know you talked a second ago about the smudge on your shirt and showing your arms, because I know I just read the Men's Health article that just came out recently.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Oh, so, it's fantastic. Yeah. It's a great read. I was prepping for this interview and I pulled it up. But you've maintained this incredible physique and you look tremendous in the new movie and on the red carpet, all these different things you've been doing. Tell me more about your regimen and how you've been able to maintain that physique, you know, into your 70s. How have you been able to maintain?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I've always been waiting for the moment when I get to be the star. You know, I came out, I'm working, it's all well and good, but I'm in somebody else's thing. So I want to be the guy. And you know, like being in school, kind of go, "Teacher, I know the answer. I'm here." You know. So I never wanted to finally get that role, and I can't do it. So for me, it's always been about not being extreme. You know, my grandmother would say, "Don't do the dumb stuff, because the dumb stuff will get you killed." Right. So you can't take things to that excess. And you know, once they really make it clear, you know, there was a time when we thought smoking wasn't so bad,
right,
but now we know. So now if you're still doing it, that's on you.
I was going to say, yeah, you know, so, better at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. There's some stuff, you know, you shouldn't eat the whole cake. You know what I mean? It's like, so there are things that I never really spent a lot of time in the gym. I just started going really about this past year. But what I would always do is, you know, the push-ups will always help the upper body and the arms. So I'll do, you know, 100 push-ups most days. I only won't say I do things every day, but the sit-ups that you learn in junior high, you know, to maintain the waist, to me, is the center of you. If you can keep your waist out, it's just much more youthful. As we get older, you know, suddenly when I turned about 72, Mr. Jiggles came to live.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't go away. He's still hanging around.
I get it. I'm working on getting rid of mine too. He's really stubborn these days. So
he's stubborn. Yeah. And he talks to you at night, you know, when the sun starts to go down, Ernie, you know, he wants to feed me, you know. So, you know, and I'm doing, say, you know, you like it.
Just a little bit will so be I fine. Work. And yeah, just work.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I can do this. I work harder tomorrow, you know. But but the only way he can survive is you got to feed him.
Yeah.
And so if you don't feed him, he will go away. So what I try to do is just eat, you know, reasonably, but nothing really extreme. Just, I used to run about 4 times a week. I don't run so much. I run a little bit every day because I hate to be on a set.
Yeah.
And they say, "Ernie, can you run from, you know, just run to that block and turn?" And I can't do it. You know, I don't want to be, you know, that guy. So, but, you know, getting the 10,000 steps, so 15,000 steps in, with a little Fitbit, you know, a monitor or some kind of watch that keeps track of my, you know, just the common sense basic stuff that we all know to do. If you're going to watch the television marathon that we love to do now, just watch every episode. At some point, get up and stretch. You know, don't just sit in a chair with a popcorn bucket and take it all in because you'll pay a price. And I think that's basically it. If there's something that's you got to check on your health, you know, a couple of times, I think it's pretty well known. I found out very early and I was able to deal with some really, really major things. But luckily, because I do the routine checkups and mm-hmm. if anything feels a little off, check it out. Don't go, well, it's not so bad. I've had this pain in my chest for about 3 weeks now. And, you know, I've been taking some aspirin. No.
Go now.
You know when it's off. You got to deal with it. So just common sense stuff.
I wanted to ask you about my second to last question here. I wanted to ask you about your new project. You're going to be playing the character of Oswald Coleman in the horror movie Oswald Down the Rabbit Hole. Tell me more about that project and, you know, tell me when we can expect to see it.
Yeah, well, we haven't started shooting yet. And I think it's spring. So they're still putting the cast and some things together. I think, honestly, I don't really know a lot. You know, I've read sort of, you know, not the completed script yet because they're still working on it. But it's really, really exciting. The filmmakers are amazing and it's a little bit different. I love finding things that I haven't had a chance to do. It's a little bit, you know, different. And an animated horror film, you know, they had sent me a trailer and the trailer was a little scary. So I thought, okay, this is going to be cool. So I'm going to discover more in the next month or so as they kind of go through some rewrites and some changes. And you know, you probably know about as much as I do right now.
Hey, that's fair. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. And I had one final question for you. My dear friend, Jeff Quinn, who is also a Ghostbusters fanatic as well, we wanted to know approximately how many Twinkie boxes do you think you've signed at some of these conventions or through your career?
There's been quite a bit. I've signed a little bit of everything, anything related to Ghostbusters. Trust me, I've signed it, including arms and limbs and legs and necks. And, you know, the Twinkies, you know, that's a big Twinkie. It's funny you say a line. You know, I think the first day I was there, we did that scene sort of in the basement. And I tell, you know, Harold explaining the size of the, you know, this activity is, you know, and I say, that's a big Twinkie. Now, I never thought, you know, 40 years later, people would love that line or, you know, tell them about the Twinkie. But, I used to, when I would go to conventions and would get a box and I'd sign each individual little wrap Twinkie. I signed a lot. I'll just put it the way I've signed, you know. I think they had in the new movie, they have little marshmallow men. They should have little Twinkie guys, you know, running around because those things will stick with you. You know, the formula, they changed the formula. And they said, somebody said that they would, you know, they never decay. Weird. I'm like, I'm not eating that. I'm not putting that in my body. No.
If you're telling me it's not going to decay or it's like McDonald's, no, please, that's a hard pass. No, I'm good.
I got to pass on that one.
Well, Ernie Hudson, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been an absolute honor and a privilege to talk to you. Tell everybody who's listening where they can keep up to date with you, your upcoming projects, and where they can find you on social media.
Yeah, social media. I think it's Ernie Hudson Official, and that's on Facebook and Instagram and I don't know, you know, and just me explaining this should tell you I don't do a lot, you know, but I try to make sure that I find out what's going on there and be in touch. So yeah, that's pretty much where you can find me.
Awesome. Thank you so much again for your time. Go out and check out Ghostbusters Frozen Empire right now. Thank you, Ernie Hudson, for your time. I appreciate it. I want to thank Paul Brown and Jeff Quinn for assisting me with my question prep here today, for having you on the show. Again, you can find me at This Is Goober on all my social media handles. And thank you for listening to Foundation Radio. My name is Adam Bernard, and we'll see you again next week. Peace.
And take care. What?
Foundation Radio is hosted, recorded, and produced by Adam Barnard. Additional narration and production is provided by the executive voice, Sam Krebs. Our mixing and engineering was done by Carl Pinnell. Our intro and outro music is performed by Dumb Ugly. Additional musical accompaniment is performed and produced by Enrichment. Our cover art photography was done by Dylan Edinger. Follow Adam on Instagram and Twitter, or X or whatever, at This Is Goober, and follow the show on Twitter, again, not calling it X, at FND Radio Pod. Find the entire show archive at foundationradio.net. This has been a Butts Carlton Media production, Butts Carlton Proprietor.
That doesn't work for me, brother.
Peace, Carl!